take number two, the morning of December the 7th.
There are several more things about Van Buren, because we would like to have your opinion about how a man who has had no special distinction, no great talents, no great qualities like Van Buren would be getting into the presidency ahead of the presidency.
Calhoun and Webster,
brilliant and able than he was during his period.
Well, they get the Calhoun, Webster, and Clay have a reputation on account of their ability to make speeches. There was not a single one of them that was any more or better qualified than Van Buren. Van Buren had had his political career in New York State. He had been appointed ambassador to Great Britain and was failed of confirmation. And when he came back, he worked with Andrew Jackson on several things, and finally became Andrew Jackson's candidate for vice president on his second term, and was elected, and was Andrew Jackson's closest advisor at that time. And I don't think he gave Andrew Jackson any bad advice on the political situation in the country. Now, as far as policy was concerned, I don't know whether he had anything to do with Jackson's policy toward the United States Bank or the other things that took place in Jackson's administration or not. But when the whole thing was finished, he was Jackson's candidate for president, and he was elected on the Jackson ticket. And then he was dilatory about making decisions. And that really was what was the matter with him. He was a fellow who tried to keep his ear to the ground and find out what people wanted, and then try to give them what they wanted, instead of having a policy of his own and selling the people that this is the best policy. And you can't do that when you're in a place of responsibility as he was.
You were going ahead to characterize Webster, Calhoun, and Clay.
Well, Webster was windbag, and never was anything else, and they're finding out that he was in the pay of the United States Bank all the time he was in the United States Senate. I guess he had to be in order to pay his bills. Calhoun was a states' rights man from South Carolina and was elected on the first ticket with Andrew Jackson as his vice president. He couldn't agree with Andrew Jackson, and neither could the old man Tyler from Virginia. Tyler resigned and Van Buren resigned. And Van Buren then was considered a great man because he resigned as vice president of the United States because he couldn't go along with the president on his policies.
You mean Van Buren, Calhoun?
Calhoun resigned because he couldn't go along with the president on his policies, and got a great reputation as a state rights man. But he was for the destruction of the Union. You know, one of the last things that Jackson said when he went out was that he was sorry he didn't have John C. Calhoun hanged and Henry Clay shot. And the reason he wanted to shoot Henry Clay was because he was one of the smear men on Jackson's marriage to Rachel. And I didn't blame him. I felt the same way about it he did. But Calhoun was strictly a state's rights man. If he'd have attained his objective, he would have broken up the Union to begin with. Jackson wouldn't stand for that. He wanted the Union preserved, and he did everything he possibly could to preserve it. Henry Clay was a compromiser. He was on the ticket in 1824 when the affair went into the House of Representatives. And he made, it is said that he made a deal with John Quincy Adams so that Adams could be elected. And then Adams made him Secretary of State, and everybody thought that was the result of the deal. Whether it was or not, I don't know. But Henry Clay was one of the greatest of the great senators, because his compromises kept the Union together until Franklin Pierce repeal the Missouri Compromise, and then that was the principal cause of the war between the states.
Clay is the compromiser on the Missouri Compromise.
That's Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850, and one or two other things that kept the Union from being broken up at that time. And then Franklin Pierce came along and signed the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, which is Stephen A. Douglas's bill in the Congress, and that caused the war to start out in Kansas and Nebraska and those states that, well, it was not decided whether they should be free or slave states. And the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, which set the slave state boundary at 3630, the southern boundary of Missouri, was one of the things that Henry Clay was responsible for. And then the Compromise of 1850 was another one. And when the repeal of those compromises took place, then trouble really began. And between old John Brown and the rest of the Bolsheviks at that time and the abolitionists, that brought on the war between the states. I think the repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850 were the principal causes of the fact that we had to shoot each other before we decided we wanted the Constitution.
In a sense, Clay was the Lyndon Johnson of his time.
That's exactly what he was. That's exactly what he was.
Now, Mr. President, the reason we brought up these three names...
a little bit unfair to bring in Lyndon Johnson on this
This is off the record.
Well, all right. You can leave it out.
The thing that brought in the names, these three names, was to get your view on how you got projected into the presidency during that period, because your only position was speech-making. You said these three men were essentially speech-makers.
That's right, they were, except Henry Clay. He was a working congressman and senator and tried his best to keep things in a position where the country would not be split. And that's the reason Henry Clay ought to be considered one of the greatest of the great senators.
Well, how did you get to be presidential timber? How did you get into the limelight in that period?
Except by speeches, is what Dave made. What else did you have to do to, besides speeches, to get into a position to be
considered
for the presidency?
Well, you had to be a legislator who was responsible for bills that would be for the welfare and benefit of the most people. And those men about whom we're talking were of that sort. Except Calhoun, he was working always for the separation of the states. And Henry Clay and Martin Van Buren and the compromisers were the ones who kept the Union together until it broke apart in 1860.
What about Webster? You haven't said very much about Webster.
Well, Webster was a windbag. He made great, many great orations. He was Secretary of State with William Henry Harrison and with Tyler and with Millard Fillmore and the old general from Buena Vista, Taylor. He was Secretary of State all during that time and I imagine did a very good job as Secretary of State, but he was still a windbag.
Get back to Dave's question. What are the things that would project a man into the limelight for a possible consideration as a president beside the oratory?
Well, in the beginning, it was the fact that he was vice president that was most in his favor to be president of the United States. And after that, his prominence in the Senate or the House was used to put him up as a candidate for president. In the elections of 1824, there were four candidates, two from the South and one from Kentucky, and then John Quincy Adams, who was from Massachusetts. And when the Congress met, it took a long time to decide the matter, and that was the second time that the election of the president had been thrown into the House of Representatives. And it was said then that Henry Clay, through his influence to John Quincy Adams, and John Quincy made him Secretary of State. Now, whether that happened or not, I don't know.
I think what Dave is trying to get at, too, is that you have erroneously, pardon me, Mr. President, often said there are a million men in this country who could have done the job that you did or qualified for the job that you
did. I think that's true.
But
they didn't have the chance. They didn't have the chance.
Well, the question I think Dave is getting at, how do a lot of men of ability get a chance? Isn't it possible that a lot of good men miss a chance?
That's true. A great many men who are well qualified to be the chief executive of the United States have been passed up and overlooked. It takes luck, conditions, and when the time comes, ability to meet that situation. And I shouldn't say that because it includes the fact that I was finally nominated and elected president of the United States.
You're on right, sir. Why don't we try to get at a little bit more objective viewpoint or a profile of a president? How would you, if you were looking to decide on whom to back as president in that period, what would you be looking for in a man?
In what period?
The period we're talking about.
The period, Van Buren 1820 to 1850.
Right.
That's the period that we're talking about. Well, in that day, the man who had the most outstanding career, either as a member of the House of Representatives or as a United States Senator or as Vice President of the United States, was the man who was always considered at that time. And the reason he was considered was because of his position and of the fact that he had displayed some idea of what the government stood for and why he should be considered as a candidate for president.
Would he have to have any special education, for instance?
He was always supposed to be a very well-educated man, and all of them were. All those men in that day were highly educated and knew the history of government from start to finish.
Well, Van Buren was not a highly educated man. He couldn't even spell.
Well, you're wrong about that. Neither could Washington. Neither could some of the rest of them spell. But Van Buren was properly educated. He had an education that very few men of his time had. And it wasn't the fact that he couldn't spell. Nobody at that time understood how to spell the English language because it took old Noah Webster to set up a dictionary so any of us could find out how to spell.
Well, I'm
Chaucer. Chaucer couldn't spell either.
But he had things to say. Mr. President, does a governorship in that period represent any political asset or
yes, I think it does. Yes, I think it does.
You omitted that. I wondered whether you thought
The governors were at that time considered along with the members of Congress. And I think there were a great many of the governors who were very able men. Great many of them got to be nominated and elected vice presidents of the United States.
Now, there were certain states, not necessarily sections, there were certain states that were key states to the nomination and election of a president.
And that is Massachusetts and Virginia.
New York didn't count in those.
New York sometimes furnished the vice president, as Clinton was one of New York's governors. He was vice president at one time.
Now, Clinton was very influential politically. And
yes,
was
he was.
In a position.
Yes, he was, and Martin Van Buren was in the same class in New York.
Now, are we all through here?
Yes, we're at the end of tape to the morning of December the 7th. This is tape 3, the morning of December the 7th, 1960. President, acting as a devil's advocate, I'd like to ask a question of about your evaluation of a historic period. You stress two things, the role of a president and the role of government. Does that mean that no progress is made and important events do not occur in other fields such as industry, commerce, science, all those other things? You emphasize the primary role of government in all these.
Of course, that's the thing I'm most interested in. But all the things you mentioned take place during that period, and a president of the United States has to take them into consideration in his evaluation of the welfare of the country. Everything you mentioned is a part of the government of the United States because it's a free government. And business and industry and the common people who work all the time have a hand in the creation of a policy.
Now, Mr. President, how would you summarize the Van Buren presidency in terms of his accomplishments, his failures, and the impression that he left on his term of office, and whether we would have done just as well not to have had him as president?
I think we would have done just as well not to have had him as president, because he was a fixer, and he was nominated because he was Andrew Jackson's vice president and supported by Andrew Jackson, and became the president of the United States at a time when it was supposed that the country had reached its keynote of prosperity. But when the Panic of 1837 came along, he was not there with remedies for that situation. Maybe that was a little early to consider a president as capable of meeting a situation of that kind. But Martin Van Buren is not one of the great presidents, in my opinion.
And therefore, he had neither skill as an administrator, nor any important contribution to make as president.
He was a politician who had gotten out of his depth, I think.
Would you venture so far as to suggest who, in your judgment, should have been the more likely occupant of the presidency during that period?
There were no prominent men in view at that time on the Democratic side. The only men who were could have been considered would have been Daniel Webster and Henry Clay, and neither one of them were in the right party at the time to be considered.
Did we have any special problems externally at that time?
Yes, we had all sorts of problems, both south of us and to the north. And those problems came out during the war between the states along the 1860s, and were finally settled by the viewpoint that the Monroe Doctrine ought to be maintained.
You were describing the summarizing the business of how you got to be president during that period, and the approach as you made it was either to the vice presidency by succession or getting into a position where you spoke, where you appeared on the hall of the, on the floor of the Congress.
Congress, either in the House or the Senate, and also in some instances as governors of one of the great states.
Now, you summarize Van Buren's performance as being very indifferent and totally unimportant.
I thought so.
Would you... Now, what happened to him after he left the White House, just to close him up?
He went back to New York and went into business up there. I forget what his business was, but he had a very successful and prosperous business. And in 1860, when a difficulty arose between the states on the secession, there were five former presidents alive after Lincoln was inaugurated, and an effort was made to have a session with those five presidents to see if they could not find some way for a compromise that would not break up the Union. Van Buren wouldn't come.
Who asked for this conference with the former presidents?
Two or three of the presidents themselves asked for it. There was Tyler. There was Van Buren, there was Franklin Pierce, there was Millard Fillmore, and Van Buren, of course, was the senior one of the presidents who had gone out of office, and he refused to come, so the conference was not held.
Aren't these virtually five among about the weakest presidents that held office?
There were five presidents who didn't leave much of a reputation as executives. But it was thought that the five of them might get together and find a way for a compromise with Abraham Lincoln, who had been sworn in as president. And I'm as sorry as I can be that the effort was not tried. It might have accomplished some purpose and postponed the Civil War.
What sort of compromise was envisaged?
I don't know. I don't know what they had in view. The objective, no doubt, was to see if they could not prevent the southern states from taking the attitude that their only remedy was secession. That was the objective, and I don't know what they had in view. No conference was held.
You said that the compromise took on just the aspect of a face saver, that there was so much commitment being made that somebody had to be provided with a basis for backing down or backing up a little.
Well, two or three of these former presidents thought maybe if they'd get together and discuss the matter with the president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, they might come to a conclusion where a shooting war would not be necessary. That was really what was in view. But it didn't come about at all.
These five presidents have any total following of any kind? Do they have any influence anywhere?
Oh, yes, of course. Every single one of them had influence in certain parts of the country.
It is said that Van Buren continued to be active politically after
that. That's right. He was well thought of in New York. And Franklin Pierce was a resident of New Hampshire and was well thought of up there. He could never have been nominated and elected for president. And the old man who was president when Lincoln took over, Buchanan, was a resident of Pennsylvania and was very well thought of up there. I don't think that the president from, the former president from New York who had been vice president, that was Millard Fillmore, I don't think he was a man of great influence because he'd been a member of the Know Nothing Party and the Anti-Masonic Party and was finally nominated and elected as vice president on the ticket with Zachariah Taylor.
No. And Tyler, did he have much influence in
Tyler was well thought of in Virginia. And when Virginia seceded, that's when Tyler decided to secede, and he was a member of the Confederate Congress from then on.
So virtually most of these presidents were from the North, weren't they?
Buchanan, Franklin Pierce, and Millard Fillmore were from the North. And so was Martin Van Buren. He was in New York. Tyler was the only one from Virginia from the South.
He was the sixth president of Virginia.
That's right. And he didn't want to see the Virginia secede, really. Tyler didn't.
So that, in effect, possibly the failure to meet together was due to the fact that they were preponderantly up at the North there?
The failure to get together was due to Martin Van Buren's refusing to appear.
This is a very significant historic piece of business here now. Would you say that Lincoln was partially at fault in not convening these former presidents?
No, I think he would have been perfectly willing to meet with them if they had been willing on their own part to meet. It's not possible for a president of the United States to tell a former president what he ought to do. But I think Lincoln would have been perfectly willing to meet and talk to these people if they had gotten together.
Well, should they have volunteered to meet with him, or was it his...
Their idea was to have a meeting in Washington and then consult the President of the United States. That's what they had in view.
They would be doing the petitioning to the President.
Yes, and that's correct. That's the way that it should have been done. And I'm very sure that Lincoln would have listened to it.
Well,
listen to their conversation.
This bears out your constant belief that some way should be made or set up to utilize the services of former presidents.
I think that's correct. Now, if these men had been ex officio members of the Congress, that situation could have been met in the Congress of the United States without a bit of difficulty, I think.
Well, now, in business, when a chief executive retires, they create and they have the institution called a President Emeritus. Do you believe in any such office as that in the United States?
No. I think if when the President finishes his job, and then this I was advocating when I was a United States Senator and before I ever thought I'd be President, a President who has served 4 years or 8 years in the chief executive position is more familiar with the operation of the government from an executive standpoint than any other man in the country. And it was my viewpoint that a former president should have an opportunity in the Senate and in the House and before the committees of the Senate and the House without a vote to appear and attain all the prerogatives of a member of the Senate and the House, in which case it would not have been necessary to have a retirement pay program for presidents, because as acting in the Senate and the House, they would have received the pay and emoluments of a senator and a representative.
Well, you make this experience available to the legislative body, and shouldn't it be made available more to the executive office?
It would be available to the executive office because they'd be in a position where the executive could call on them to for discussion anytime he felt like it. much easier than it would be from private life.
Well, then, how do you implement this kind of thing? What do you do to make this possible?
It takes a bill through the Congress to authorize the former presidents of the United States to be ex officio members of the House and the Senate. Members of Congress, they can do that by legislation. It's no trouble.
That wouldn't require a constitutional amendment.
No, it wouldn't require any constitutional amendment at all, in my opinion. And that's the opinion that's been expressed since 1889, when it was first proposed.
When was it first proposed?
1889.
By whom?
I don't know who proposed it, but it was proposed at the time that Cleveland was elected the second time.
Now, Mr. President, do you feel that this thing is important enough for some facility to be established in Washington, perhaps a residence for former presidents so they could be available?
Oh, I don't know that that's necessary.
Would you go that far?
No, I don't think that's necessary. If they were made ex officio members of the Congress for both houses to have a chance to discuss bills on the floor of either house if they chose, and to be members in such a situation that they could attend committee meetings and hear everything that went on, I don't think there'd be any other reason for any further emoluments, because they would have the staff appropriations for the House or the Senate, whichever were the greater appropriations, and would be in a position, so it wouldn't be necessary to provide a residence for them. They could do that themselves. That wouldn't be any trouble.
Well, just to bring in an issue here of continuity and the fact that foreign policy has been fairly continuing in all essential respects for the last 20, 25 years. And here we have a Khrushchev who says, I will wait until the next president. Now, there was some way of not abruptly cutting off the association of a former president with that policy. In view of this new development of dictators around the world that we have to do business with, wouldn't that cushion that a little bit?
Well, I'm sure it would. I always thought it would. And that was way back in the 1930s when I was a member of the Senate, when that matter was discussed by several senators.
This is the end of tape 3, morning of December 7th, 1968.